And so in 2008, they established the SRAM Cycling Fund, which is a $10 million, $2 million a year fund for cycling advocacy. The focus is infrastructure, changing the way streets and trails are available in communities across the United States and also Europe.
Well, does that get your attention? It did for me the first time I heard Randy Neufeld describe just what his day job is. $10 million. Well, that's a lot of cycling advocacy he gets to look at. And so along the way, I believe he's become quite knowledgeable, perceptive, as to what's effective bicycle advocacy and what isn't. And that's the nature of today's show. And you're listening to CDM Cyclist, and I'm your host, Frank Peters. Welcome back again. Of course, you've heard me. How many times have you heard me say, make some reference to the California Bike Summit? It was a few months ago. I met some world-class characters at that time. And Randy, in particular, he was the last speaker of the event. And it ended with a bang. Let me connect the dots for you there. He called his talk Power Moves. Power Moves for Bicycling Coalitions. Advocacy groups in different locales often organize into coalitions. Here in Orange County, we've got the Orange County Bicycle Coalition, for example. So how to be effective, how to be more effective, what to do, where to be careful. Don't spin your wheels in some projects that aren't going to yield. Well, that's what we get into in today's show. Well, Randy has a lot to say, so let's get right to it. So I interviewed Tim Blumenthal at Bikes Belong during spring break. So I've been in the offices.
All right.
And I know exactly where you are. What's the weather like today in Boulder, Randy?
That's a very interesting question. So when I arrived on Wednesday, I took a B-cycle bike for a bike ride on a beautiful sunny day, 60 degrees.
Uh-huh.
The next morning I woke up, it was 25 and there was 4 inches of snow on the ground. And this morning, I don't know if you can see out the window here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can.
It's much colder. It's about 15 degrees out there.
Ooh.
So it's the changing weather of Boulder.
Well, of course, we both love Boulder because it has a fabulous bicycle infrastructure, doesn't it?
It does. It's got 77 underpasses, I learned.
Oh, boy. Wow. So I took my, soon-to-be college-age son to Boulder. He says he wants to go to school at CU, and we had never been, so we rented bikes and went all over town. Turns out I have an old friend in Boulder and took us on bike rides, and we had a great time. It's an easy place to live. Now, do you live in the area too, Randy? Is this home?
I live in Chicago. I'm just here for 3 days.
Oh, well, good. Good for you. Okay, very good. You and I met, Randy, at the recent California Bike Summit.
Right.
And many people in the audience knew of you. You got a very warm reception. And then almost immediately, people asked you to sing. What's going on there?
That's a really interesting story. It all starts with a woman named Susie Stevens, who was a bicycle organizer. She ran the Washington State Bicycle Advocacy Group, and she and I were part of the Thunderhead Alliance, the beginning of the Thunderhead Alliance, which is now the Alliance for Biking and Walking. She was the first administrative director of that organization. And we would meet a couple times a year at retreats and other events, and she was a lot of fun at campfires. We like to sing together, and she often said, "There's no movement without music."
Hey, there you go. I love that. That's fantastic.
She was a great, a great singer. And then in 2003, she was killed crossing the street in St. Louis by a turning bus. It was a very tragic thing, a big blow to a lot of us. Lost a very dear friend and a great leader in the movement. And as a sort of result of that, I had the courage to sing the song we sang at a Bike to Work Day with Mayor Daley in 2004. And it was a big hit, and I sort of used that song and some other singing at some other events. It's not something I characteristically did, but was a way to sort of honor a woman who had the courage to do it and gave me and others who weren't public singers the courage to do it.
Oh, that's a lovely story, Randy.
It's part of the great folk tradition of using music to stir social change.
Well, and how memorable. I say sometimes I go to conferences for a living. I have never seen a speaker start off with a song. So you're up there in rare category with me, Randy. Now, Randy, you had quite a message for those of us in the audience. I'm a new bicycle advocate, hearing a lot of things for the first time. Well, I'd like to talk about the fund that you operate, uh-huh. Randy. You evaluate advocacy projects, right?
Right. I work for the SRAM Corporation, which is a bicycle component manufacturer. So they make RockShox and Truvative and Avid and SRAM drivetrain, products like SRAM Red and XX. And it's a very righteous company in that they want to see, you know, not just good components on the market, but they want to see the benefits that cycling brings to the world achieved. Mm-hmm. And so in 2008, they established the SRAM Cycling Fund, which is a $10 million, $2 million a year fund for cycling advocacy. The focus is infrastructure, changing the way streets and trails are available in communities across the United States and also Europe, which are the primary markets for SRAM products. Mm-hmm, and we focus mainly on advocacy, and we work a lot with other companies in the bike industry, including our competitors, just to try to grow cycling.
Because growing cycling is, of course, good for business, right?
It's good for business, but it's, I think, more importantly, good for the planet.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Now, a $10 million fund, $2 million a year. Let's just scale that for a second. Compared to lots of other initiatives, some might think that's not a lot of money, but does that go further than one might think in the bicycle infrastructure world?
Well, it would not go very far if we use the money to directly fund cycling infrastructure. But if we fund advocacy for cycling infrastructure, and that advocacy is aimed at changing government priorities and changing the way transportation is funding. So public investment goes towards cycle tracks and trails. The money goes a lot further. So we like to think about a double leverage. The first leverage is that other companies and government agencies are also funding the projects that we're funding. And the second leverage is that is the public investment that actually buys the infrastructure. So maybe $1 million ends up buying $1 billion of cycling infrastructure.
Oh, so quite a bit of leverage there then.
Yes.
Get it. Yeah, yeah. So there's no two ways about it, though. In the time since you presented, you've been kind enough to share your Power Moves for Bike Coalitions, and you sent that around. With your permission, Randy, I'd like to attach that to the blog post with our interview here. Would that
be all right? Yeah, that would be
great. Yeah, good.
That would be great.
Good.
It's an interesting piece. I developed a presentation on cycling advocacy and power probably 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And mostly at that time, I would say our movement was in a much more fringe position. We weren't really buddies with mayors and city councils and congress people. We didn't really have a lot of allies in places of power. And so I talked about ways that mostly volunteer operations could be more powerful or look more powerful. Things like making sure you have a good business card and.
Oh, that's a good one too, isn't it?
Just
to have a business card in the first place.
To have a business card and to think about mainstream resources. And if you can't hire a lot of staff, what semi-retired people have time to help you out? And all sorts of those kinds of things. That sort of evolved into a set of values that the Chicagoland Bicycle Federation and then the Active Transportation Alliance in Chicago. That's a not-for-profit organization that I ran for 20 years in the city of Chicago. So it was a set of values, propositions on how we did our advocacy work. And some of the bullets you see on that document are, were part of that values resolution. And then, I had a sort of a checklist of these things. And when I went to the California Bike Summit, I sat around for a couple of days listening to the assembled strategize.
Yes.
And I thought, well, some of these things would be good tips for focusing the strategy, because I think that was one of my main conclusions. It was 2 days of a waterfall, a flood, really, of brilliant ideas.
Right.
And a group trying to figure out how, as a statewide coalition, do we implement all of these brilliant ideas? And any one or two of those ideas could take all of everyone's time. And
right,
so the question,
right.
How do you prioritize? And so try to present some principles for thinking about among a set of good ideas. So among a box of diamonds of really good things, which are the best ones? And what kind of criteria do you use to select the best next steps?
And, of course, everybody wants to listen to you because you've got money behind you, Randy. So that adds a certain gravity to these points. Let's nibble on a couple of these, Randy, because this list is fantastic. And for me, some of these were like a little bit, let's say, a slap in the face, right? I was more software-oriented than hardware-oriented in my thinking. What do you mean when you say, be more focused on hardware than software?
Well, hardware, first of all, is the built environment. It's the streets, the design of the streets, the cycle tracks, the bike lanes, the trails, the conditions that you're riding in. The software are the encouragement programs, the promotion type activities. And
that's like organizing a ride.
Organizing a ride or talking to your coworker about how they really could give biking to work a try, or a program where you give lollipops to kids so that they'll bike to school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not suggesting that as a method, but just saying those kinds
right, in
of,
general, right.
Yeah, you basically give them some good marinating.
You're not anti-lollipop.
Exactly. I'm not anti-lollipop, but so those kinds of encouragement activities, those are also good things. In my experience and observations of what has changed levels of cycling in cities, primarily in the U.S. and in Europe, and asking a lot of questions and seeing what's going on, the one thing that I'm convinced of is that the built environment is the most important factor. That if conditions are harsh or dangerous, you can get a few people out there, but you're not really going to get to the mainstream. And so I see that as the most important. At the same time, that doesn't mean that's all you do, because you can embellish and leverage the built environment improvements by doing the other encouragement programs. Mm-hmm. Often, as advocates, we work on the soft side because it's easier to get a handle on. It's easier to go to the office place and start an encouragement program than it is to go to the city and change the way the streets look.
Right. That's not easy. Yeah.
It's not easy. My suggestion is that while it's not easy, it's worth doing because it's the one thing that will last. And it's in many ways, one of the few things that will really work.
So Randy, for me now, I had been under the delusion that, well, I like this idea for one. And I'm subscribing to it now, and I've shared this with a lot of my bicycle advocate buddies here, too. But for a while, as I get started, and because I'm new to getting back on my bicycle again, I was thinking some of the soft stuff would help me find more fellow advocates in the community. And we need to do that here, too. So, well, like you say, it's a balance, isn't it?
I think what you're saying there is very true. In fact, it is working on the soft stuff over the last few decades that has gotten us to the point where we've got enough cycling going on in communities that we can actually be in a realistic position to pursue the hard stuff.
Right. So it is a balancing act.
It has not been wasted work, but it has been a tough slog.
Right.
And I think, you know, I gave the example, sort of the poster child of cycling change is the city of Sevilla in Spain that went from 0.04% cycling levels. That's less than a half of 1% of all travel was by bicycle. Basically, that means you don't see bicycles at all.
Right.
When you go down the city street, to over 7% of travel, which means you see bicycles all the time everywhere you're going in Sevilla. And that happened in 3 years, and it was predominantly an infrastructure investment in a network of cycle tracks and a shared bike system.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by a cycle track?
A cycle track is changing the street right-of-way so the cyclist is not sharing the right-of-way with cars but is separated from the motor vehicle traffic by some kind of buffer. Usually it's some sort of physical buffer. In some cases, it's just a painted area. But a traditional Dutch or Danish style cycle track has the cycle track immediately next to the sidewalk or the parkway area, and then you've got some sort of buffer or parking, auto parking, and then you have your motor vehicle travel lanes, and then it's either two ways on one side of the street or there's one on each side of the street.
Mm-hmm. In your handout here, Randy, you talk about the hottest things you've seen, and you name the protected or cycle tracks.
Right.
You also mention, bike share. That's increasingly popular. Of course, New York is, I guess, going to do it in 2012. There's a lot of momentum in bike share projects.
Right. We're making some baby steps in the United States. The biggest cities like New York and Chicago are just coming online. You should see systems in both of those cities in 2012. There are literally hundreds of systems with hugely successful systems in Paris, Barcelona, London. And these are systems with thousands of bikes that are available at automated stands every block or two throughout the city. And it's really, you think of it as a bicycle public transport system. Mm-hmm. So you have trains for the longest trips. You have buses for the medium length trips, and then you have bikes available for the short trips. And they've become integral parts of those cities' transit systems.
And you have them in Boulder now too, right?
There's definitely a system in Boulder. It's a good system. It's not as comprehensive as you would find in, say, Washington, D.C., which is the most active U.S. system.
Mm-hmm.
So if Boulder had about four times as many stations, you'd probably get to a critical mass where you'd start seeing a lot more use.
Mm-hmm. Some of my friends in Long Beach, that they're looking at bike share, they say density matters. So big cities have an advantage with bicycle share.
Well, I don't know if they have an advantage. In some ways, it's a disadvantage because they have to put so many stations in.
Yeah.
In Europe, there's a lot of small cities with great systems, but you just need enough density so you can cover the kinds of destinations that people are going to. And so if you only have a few choices, like for a long time, Washington, D.C. had 10 stations. And this was a previous system to the current Capital Bike Share system. And it didn't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have, literally a station every block throughout most of the city. And that gives you enough choices that it becomes a real option. It motivates you to want to join, become a member of the system, and gives you opportunities to use it regularly.
It makes me think there, as you describe Washington and their prior attempt at this, that must have added some challenges to the advocates, because people could say, look, we've got a system. It's not that popular, I guess.
Yeah, there's some questions about whether you can do a demonstration for bike share. And what I would suggest is you can demonstrate that the equipment works.
Mm-hmm.
You can demonstrate that the bikes don't get stolen. You can demonstrate a lot of things. But to really demonstrate the functionality of the system, you have to build it. It's like trying to show that buses work by building one bus route. That doesn't work.
Right. Randy, let's go back to Power Moves for Bike Coalitions. And we're going to, my listeners can come to the website and download a copy and follow along. Carrots and sticks is a favorite here. Make driving harder, the sticks, and biking easier, carrots. Now, as a newbie bike advocate, I was always kind of like hedging my bets or afraid to actually come out and say, we got to make driving harder. But you hit that nail right on the head, Randy.
So if you look at Chicago and you look at where you see a lot of bikes being ridden, it's the neighborhoods that are congested with traffic and where parking is expensive. And that's because suddenly in those neighborhoods, it's cheaper and faster to use a bike.
Jeez, that makes me think of San Francisco, too.
Yeah, and so there are suburbs in Chicago that have good bicycle routes and bicycle trails all over town. It's pretty easy to get anywhere on a bike, but hardly anybody rides in those suburbs. And the reason is because there's no congestion, there's free parking everywhere, everybody's got two cars.
Right,
and
at least.
So the resistance to driving is very low, and so it makes a bike trip less competitive. So mm-hmm. you start thinking about cycling as something that you're trying to make more competitive as opposed to just making it attractive. And as advocates, we've often worked on the attraction side, which is a good thing to do, but we have to think seriously about the disincentive to automobile use side.
Politicians, of course, cringe at the idea, right? They're afraid that their phones will ring off the hook if they, for example, remove street parking to put in
remove
a cycle
street
track.
Parking or any of those sorts of things.
Right.
So that means this is really the big challenge for bicycle advocates in the United States, is how do we create these disincentives? One of the ways is we need to partner with other interests that would also be interest in certain aspects of disincentives. So one of the most common things in the U.S. is to remove a travel lane to put in a bicycle facility. And so that's something that's both an incentive and a disincentive because you're reducing automobile capacity. And we've been able to do that on a case-by-case basis or in certain instances, and politicians' phones haven't rung off the hook. The other thing that you can do is just work with parking policy. So, for instance, it may not be in a local retail area's interest to provide free parking because it may be there isn't enough on-street parking available. It doesn't attract enough customers to a particular urban location. And so managing the parking and actually pricing the parking may help the health of that retail area. There's a guy named Don Shoup from California there. Yes. He's a professor. He's got a book called The High Price of or The High Cost of Free Parking.
I know. That's a great book, by the way. I concur with Randy here. It's a big book, though, isn't it? It's quite the doorstop. It's
There's a lot of good blogs and online articles summarizing Dr. Shoup's work. So you can
speed read it that way.
You can find some good stuff. But the point is that there's ways to work on parking policy that might help incentivize local travel by bicycle. And, there's probably, we could talk about gas taxes and other sorts of things. I don't have a lot of easy answers there, but it's worth thinking about. I think the one easy lesson there is if we are trying to make cycling more attractive and we have limited resources in doing that, if we put those resources in places where it's already a little more difficult to drive, in places where there's higher congestion, higher priced parking, the chance of that cycling succeeding in those locations is greater because those disincentives are already
in place. Well, that's great. Now, that's a little bit counterintuitive, isn't it? I could hear the car enthusiasts saying, what? It's already crowded with traffic, and I'm trying to get to work, but you make a good point, Randy. There's opportunities with those carrots and sticks in high congestion areas. May I move on? I've really been building up to one of my favorites on your list here is, you put it so bluntly again, Randy. I love bluntness, too. Get people hired, get people fired. Now, it's the holidays. You don't mean to be quite so heartless there, but what's the point behind this?
Well, I don't mean to be heartless, but if there's particular politicians or particular professionals, planners, engineers who are standing in the way of communities achieving benefits that are vital, economic benefits, health benefits that come through having a robust biking and walking system in their communities. And there are people whose attitudes and actions are challenges. It's been my experience that it's often very difficult to convince those people to change. And sometimes the easiest thing to do is to get them replaced.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think we need to respect people, but we also, I've seen advocates in places banging their head against a wall for decades because individuals have created roadblocks. The other side of the coin is that often in advocacy, opportunities present themselves. There's a new mayor or a new governor, and they're appointing a new secretary of transportation or a new commissioner, or there's a new administration and they're filling some new key roles. To really be active about suggesting good people to fill those positions, and you will save yourself a lot of time and energy by getting good people in those places.
Makes me think. We've got a new mayor here in Newport Beach, California. A new mayor takes over in just 10 days, and she has chaired the Bike Safety Committee for well over a year now. So that's encouraging, huh? I never thought of it that way, but she'll have more clout, and she's got the track record. She knows what the issues are. Maybe we can get excited about seeing change happen more quickly. That's great.
We fought for bikes on trains in Chicago for years. And it was always, oh, we can't do it because of liability.
Oh, geez.
We got a new CTA president. Frank Cruzzi came in. Bikes were on trains in a matter of months. And they never brought the liability issue up. And it's completely a leadership issue.
So, Tom, I suppose the message there is if you're a traffic or transportation engineer and you're inclined to embrace these transportation choices that we're all talking about, there are career opportunities ahead for you.
That's hopefully they'll all think that way.
Great. Well, Randy, let's go back to the fund for a second because I'm thinking, what's a typical size of grant? And tell me a little bit about, like, if some of the advocates listening, they'd like to apply, maybe you've got some suggestions on how to succeed at that process.
Well, most of the advocates listening are probably not in a good position to directly receive SRAM Cycling Fund. We fund mostly national-level projects. We try to deal a little bit more wholesale than retail. So, for instance, one of our big projects that we fund for $400,000, it goes to the League of American Bicyclists and the Alliance for Biking and Walking. It's a project called Advocacy Advance. And the purpose of this project is to transfer the best practices from places that do a good job seizing funding opportunities to places that have more trouble with similar opportunities in their area. So if San Francisco is good at getting air quality money for cycling facilities, then maybe Atlanta has some things they can learn about what San Francisco's doing that they can get similar funds in Atlanta. So it's the idea is to try to get to work with existing transportation funding sources and figure out ways to create more opportunities for cycling and to get more capacity to the advocates working on that. So there's winning campaigns trainings that are available. There's a set of workshops that people could get, and there's also a grant program. And we fund all of those activities that state and local advocates can take advantage of, but the SRAM Cycling Fund doesn't directly give grants to state and local advocates.
I got it.
There's a website, advocacyadvance.org, that they could check out the grant program and the opportunities that are there.
Randy, back to the hottest things I've seen. According to you, Open Streets, you call it Ciclovia. That makes your top four. What do you like so much about Open Streets?
Open Streets opens up a whole new dimension of opportunity for cycling advocacy. You know, we've gone into the issue of changing the way public space is used. Open Streets changes the way time is used. So just because a street is dedicated to cars during certain periods of time doesn't mean it always has to be dedicated to cars. And the idea that you could use existing infrastructure at special times for secure, traffic-free cycling and walking and rollerblading and all these sorts of things is a very exciting idea. There are 16 Latin American cities that have active ciclovia-type programs where for a number of hours, usually on a Sunday, they opened up a whole network turning streets into trails for a half a day. And it's such a cool idea because it's completely scalable. You could do 120 kilometers of routes like they do in Bogota, or you could do just a few kilometers. You could do it 70 days a year like they do in Bogota, or you could try it once and see how it works. You know, there's an operations cost, but there isn't a infrastructure cost.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, Los Angeles, you've seen the stories too, Randy, has done a couple of these now, and they are wildly successful. It's just unbelievable how popular they are.
Yeah, El Paso, Miami, Portland, New York City, Chicago, Madison. There's been a whole set of them, and they are, you know, they're pretty much wildly popular wherever they go on. Nobody in the U.S. has gotten to the Bogota level, though, which is the every Sunday closure, and I think that's the golden prize.
That's the next step. So the big advantage of these open street ciclovias is it shows the media and it shows the politicians that there's great opportunities, great enthusiasm with their constituents for these choices.
Yeah, it has the ability to build towards something else, but do not discount the value of it in and of itself.
Okay.
That you are providing opportunities for active mobility within neighborhoods that are very much deprived of those opportunities. So it's a value in itself, and it can also build towards and build enthusiasm for other things.
It gets everybody talking.
Right.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
When the city council sees thousands of people out there on a Saturday or a Sunday, then when somebody brings a bike network proposal to them, they might think it's a little more sensible to look at that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Randy, it's been a thrill to have you on the show this morning, and I personally felt I learned a great deal from your Power Moves for Bike Coalitions, and thank you for letting me have your notes and make them available to my listeners. Thank you very much for joining me on the show today, Randy.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Alrighty. Bye-bye. We're back in the studio, and as we hinted at there, Randy gave me, a friend of his in the audience, made notes on the points he made during his talk at the California Bicycle Summit. And Randy turned those notes over to me, and I turned it into a lovely one-page PDF file. I guess it's two pages. So come by the website, cdmcyclist.com, and download your own copy. Pass it around to others in your bicycle coalition. Yeah, I think it's going to help. Well, in the meantime, you enjoyed today's interview. Why don't you come by the website, make a comment. Randy would love to hear what's on your mind, and so would I. So that's cdmcyclist.com. Leave a comment behind, please. All right. Well, that's it for tonight's show. Thanks so much for listening, and good night.